Welcome to the Three Martini Lunch. Grab a stool next to Greg Corumbus of Radio America and Jim Garrity of National Review. Three Martinis coming up.
Really glad you're with us for the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Thanks for being here. Your stool is prepared. And also thank you for your wonderful comments yesterday, congratulating us on our 11 years. Happy to be diving into year 12 here. And Jim, I feel like we're only about 12 days away from Election Day. I think it's actually 13. But nonetheless, I did not expect, given Virginia's recent electoral history, to be spending a lot of good martinis talking about this year's governor's race. But here we are, largely due to the fact of Terry McAuliffe's own doing, his performance at the debate where he wanted parents not having a say in what school boards are doing and decisions they're making and so forth was about the best gift that Glenn Youngkin could have gotten in this race, and it just keeps going. McAuliffe doing so much damage control, now he's actually out with an ad saying that Youngkin's comments or his criticism of McAuliffe was taken out of context. So when you put out an ad trying to explain what you said before, that's never a good position to be in. Youngkin's out with a new ad showing seven times where McAuliffe said that parents shouldn't be making these decisions. But the latest problem for Terry McAuliffe, as this October does not go well for him, is in an interview he did with the local DC ABC affiliate, ABC 7 WJLA, where he was given 20 minutes for this interview, as was Glenn Youngkin. McAuliffe, however, and his team, they cut it short, even though McAuliffe says in this clip, erroneously, that he gave him extra time.
He says election integrity is the number one issue. No, it isn't. Healthcare, COVID, education, job.
And finally.
Okay. All right, we're over. That's it. Hey, I gave you extra time. Come on, man. You should have asked better questions early on. Your viewers care about.
Well,
we did.
That's my favorite part at the end where he's like, you should have asked questions that your viewers care about. And the interviewer is like, we did. And so Jonathan Elias is the anchor of ABC 7 explaining to all the viewers in D.C. last night what actually happened right there.
So if you watch those entire interviews on our website, we do want to point out that the Terry McAuliffe interview is shorter than our interview with Glenn Youngkin. That was not by our doing. Nick offered both candidates 20 minutes exactly to be fair for the interviews. McAuliffe abruptly ended 7 News' interview after just 10 minutes and told Nick that he should have asked better questions and that Nick should have asked questions 7 News viewers care about. That's what he said.
And so apparently enough of the questions were about his problems with the education issue that McAuliffe and his team decided to cut it off. So, Jim, how is this going to affect Election Day? I don't know. We've had early voting since mid-September. Who knows how many have voted, how many still are going to vote. But if there are any on the fence, that might not be a huge number, but if there are any on the fence, Terry McAuliffe is not doing himself any favors here, and that's good news.
Greg, right before we started taping, I'm setting up our connection. We're getting ready, and there's a knock at the door. Now, you have heard me in the past when either the phone rings and we're about to tape or someone's at the door and we're about to tape, and it's not someone who I wanted to call me or greet me. I try to be a nice person, but sometimes I can be abrupt, and I don't really believe that I'm obligated to treat telemarketers like they're human beings with dignity and respect and all that kind of stuff. St. Peter's going to really be irked at me when I meet my maker on this front. But anyway, so I get there, and it's some kid. I'm like, oh, God, what is he selling? Greg, it was a Youngkin volunteer.
Volunteer. Wow.
Looked like maybe college age, you know, by the way, notice I'm at the age right now, say somebody in college is a young kid. But anyway, and I was like, give me the material, got to tape something, see ya. He's like, okay, and you just come in. But like, we don't usually get Republican volunteers going door to door here in Authenticity Woods. This is in Fairfax County. McConnell won very narrowly back in 2009, but generally since then, it's been pretty reliably Democratic. I have no idea what kind of greeting this poor young guy is getting as he goes door to door, but I don't remember there being door to door Republican door knockers in this neighborhood in past cycles. I don't know if this means they got a better effort. I don't know if they got more volunteers. I don't know if there's, but it's just kind of an interesting indicator. The other thing that I think this little exchange about Terry McAuliffe, and let's put it, he's not outraged. He's not storming off in a really frustrated huff. It's kind of, There's a certain amount of playfulness to it, but it does seem strange because, look, candidates run late all the time. Where does Terry McAuliffe have to go that he can't take another 10 minutes to continue this interview? It certainly seems like he didn't like the way this interview was going and decided, that's it, I'm out of here. And obviously, instead of being... The story is not about the answers of Terry McAuliffe and Glenn Youngkin. The story is now about Terry McAuliffe getting up and walking out halfway through what was supposed to be a 20-minute interview. And again, I have a really tough time seeing what was going on. Was there a building on fire? Was there a puppy that needed to... Why is Terry McAuliffe so frustrated? I said, I got to get out of here. Who's the scheduler and what's going on that requires this? And this is just one last thing that's kind of starting to permeate my thinking as Election Day gets closer. So Terry McAuliffe is the former governor of Virginia. We don't allow our governors to run for two consecutive terms, but he was elected back in 2013, and he won up against Ken Cuccinelli and Libertarian Robert Sarvis, dripping off, you know, peeling off a little bit of votes there. I wrote a profile of Ken Cuccinelli. I think my conclusion after that, maybe I caught Ken Cuccinelli on a bad day. I remember coming away and saying, okay, this is a very bright guy. This is a guy who really knows his stuff backwards and forwards. And I remember 4 years earlier in the attorney general race, man, he just pantsed a guy in one of the debates where he asked him some basic questions about how does the attorney general's office work? And the guy just stammered. And it was clear he had not done his homework, so to speak, and just didn't understand, couldn't name the offices, couldn't name the duties, just came across as this empty suit who didn't know the job he was going into. But Ken Cuccinelli did not win in 2013, and I think he was not maybe a quart low in the charisma and schmoozing department. Smart guy. If I was ever on trial, I'd want him to be my lawyer, but not necessarily a guy who's going to be the backslapping, you know, kind of guy that you have to be often to win a statewide race. And Terry McAuliffe, you know, had that aspect of the job, you know, nailed down pat. But I kind of wonder if that, you know, 1 year after Obama wins re-election was just a general overall better environment for Democrats, and that Terry McAuliffe is kind of an overrated candidate. He certainly has seemed to have, you know, fallen apart in these last couple of weeks here in Virginia. And he certainly seems to have, you know, the wind at his back, and it's a blue-leaning state, and, you know, just seems to be stepping on a rake over and over again. And I'm also starting to wonder whether Glenn Youngkin, who is also not a whirling dervish of raw political charisma, is maybe a little better than we thought, that he has managed to get the issue, you know, the electorate focused on the issue that he wants, particularly education, and the comeback he had, because, McAuliffe had said, you know, talking about critical race theory, it's a racist dog whistle issue or something like that. So he gets asked by this, I think, by Josh Krashauer of National Journal. And Youngkin just comes back and says, I'm not going to take any lectures from a guy who had called upon Ralph Northam to resign after the Klan hood and blackface photo, then forgot about it, turned around, asked for his endorsement, got his endorsement, and is now running ads, or at least was running ads, touting the endorsement of Ralph Northam, a.k.a. Coon Man, a.k.a., you know. And so that was a good answer. That was really turning around and just a, you know, strong left hook there. So, or I should say he's a Republican right hook. But added up, like, you know, maybe Youngkin's better than we thought. Maybe McAuliffe is worse than we thought. And, you know, storming off in mid-interview, that certainly is not an indicator that Terry McAuliffe is feeling great as we head into the final stretch here.
No, I think you're right about that. There's also the national factors, which also play into Virginia. Last time, of course, there was the government shutdown, which worked to McAuliffe's advantage against Cuccinelli. And then Cuccinelli had momentum closer to Election Day because of all the problems with the healthcare.gov site. But ultimately, McAuliffe eked it out. Biden's obviously not doing great right now. That's why Mark Warner specifically went public saying we have to pass the infrastructure bill so we can help get Terry McAuliffe elected, which is exactly not how politics is supposed to work in Washington, but often does. And so, Jim, we'll see. I mean, Virginia has been pretty blue in statewide elections. So if McAuliffe can squeak it out, I think Democrats are going to learn exactly the wrong lesson from this and go pedal to the metal for the next year and not find the same results nationwide. But maybe Youngkin can pull this off. And if he can, the narrative will be vastly different. Mm-hmm. Well, as Jonathan Elias said, you can watch those videos online at their website. But when you go online, sometimes you make assumptions that aren't actually true, like browsing in incognito mode. You think it's safe, but is it really? I mean, it's part of the Chrome browser. They're all Google products, and Google's made a fortune by tracking your movements online, selling your information to retailers and stuff. And, you know, your privacy is not as private as you think it is. There's even a $5 billion class action lawsuit against Google in California where it's accused of secretly collecting user data. Their defense? Incognito does not mean invisible. So how do you actually make yourself as invisible as possible? You've got to get ExpressVPN.
It turns out that even in incognito mode, your online activity still gets tracked and data brokers still get to buy and sell your data. And one of these data points is your IP address. Data harvesters use your IP address to uniquely identify you and your location. With ExpressVPN, your connection gets rerouted through an encrypted server and your IP address is masked. Now, every time you connect to ExpressVPN, you get a random IP address that is shared by lots of other ExpressVPN customers. That makes it much harder for third parties to identify you or harvest your data. Best of all, ExpressVPN is super easy to use. No matter what device you're on, whether it's a phone or a laptop or a smart TV, all you have to do is tap one button for instant protection.
Reliable protection could not be easier to set up. So if you really want to go incognito and protect your privacy, secure yourself with the number one rated VPN. Visit expressvpn.com/martini, and you'll also get 3 extra months for free. That's expressvpn.com/martini. Go to expressvpn.com/martini to learn more. All right, Jim, let's move to our bad martini now. And for anyone who's had anything to do with energy prices in the last, really 9 months since Joe Biden took office, you know that they're a lot higher than they used to be. And of course, some of this was very deliberate on Biden's part. Day one, scrapping authorization for the Keystone XL pipeline. In fact, just this week I heard that the company that's building the pipeline actually dug up the pipe that goes underneath the Canadian-U.S. border. So he's scrapped that. He's talked about reducing the ability of energy companies to explore on federal land. And ultimately, he wants to pretty much be done with fossil fuels sometime next decade. Well, there's that dream on the left, and then there's the reality. And thankfully, the Wall Street Journal has taken a close look at this, because as Biden and other factors are forcing our energy prices up, there's some truth that we all need to know. An energy price shock, writes the Journal, is serving as a reminder of the world's continued dependency on fossil fuels, even amid efforts to shift to renewable sources of energy. Demand for oil, coal, and natural gas has skyrocketed worldwide in recent weeks as unusual weather conditions and resurgent economies emerging from the pandemic combined to create energy shortages from China to Brazil to the UK. This situation has laid bare the fragility of global supplies as countries drive to pivot from fossil fuels to cleaner sources of energy, a shift many investors and governments are trying to accelerate amid concerns about climate change. But here comes the problem. The transition figures to be challenging for years to come, energy executives and analysts say, due to a stark reality. While fossil fuel investment is falling, fossil fuels account for most energy, and green energy spending isn't growing fast enough to fill the gap. And it's not just the spending. The supply of renewable energy simply can't match the abundance, the affordability, and the reliability of the energy we do get from coal and natural gas. So, Jim, it would have been nice if people would have acknowledged this reality before our gas prices shot up, 50% or more at this point from when Biden took office. But hopefully somebody's paying attention.
Greg, I remember not that long ago, say one administration ago, where we had this all of the above approach and the idea that, yes, we wanted to develop renewables, solar and wind and all that, you know, happy stuff that shows up in Democratic campaign commercials. And we also wanted to develop our, you know, natural gas, clean coal, you know, you name the form of energy. We wanted to do it. And hey, you know, boy, imagine if we built a nuclear power plant and had zero carbon emissions. Yes, we have to deal with nuclear waste. Yucca Mountain sure would be nice, but or Yucca Mountain, Yucca, whatever. It'd be nice to have a mountain in Nevada. We could store all that stuff, but no. Apparently, we're not allowed to do any of that kind of stuff, and we're just supposed to watch gradually increasing, or in some cases dramatically increasing, demand and not worry at all about supply. Now, all of this comes, Greg, as you know, not that long ago, we were like, oh my goodness, the United States was a net total energy exporter in 2019 until 2020. Now, this is, you know, the first time since the 1950s we had become an energy exporter. Like, holy smokes, you know, this is huge. This is great. Remember how dependent we used to be on foreign oil, dependent on Saudi Arabia, Russia, Venezuela, all these regimes we don't like. We set this as a goal and we did it. And now all of a sudden we're running out of energy? Huh? Well, how did this happen? How, you know, not that much has changed. Well, actually, one big change over at the head of the executive branch. But you look at these headlines, like, there's never a good time to have an energy crisis. There's never a good time to have, oh, energy prices are going to go up really high. But this would seem to be a particularly bad one when you've got really, you know, runaway inflation on a variety of fronts, groceries and stuff like that. And this was over at Reuters just a day or two ago. Nearly half of U.S. households rely on natural gas for heat. And the average cost for these homes is expected to rise by 30% to $746 for the October to March period from the same time a year earlier. The average cost of a home with natural gas last winter was $573, far cheaper than other major sources of heat. You know, like, if you're already feeling squeezed by every time you refill the tank of your car, you're already feeling squeezed when you go to the grocery store, you're already feeling squeezed, you know, they can't, some talk, we've got, you know, places are going to have a hard time finding turkeys for Thanksgiving, empty shells for toys, like, you know, you're just feeling squeezed everywhere. And now all of a sudden you're going to have much higher home heating bills. Are you kidding? You know, we're going to have, you know, it's going to make the tea party look like a mild gathering. Come winter. And I cannot believe that we're seeing, you know, people like Jen Psaki crack jokes about treadmills being slow to deliver, or some idiotic comment about the blue mug versus the purple mug, when these are the sorts of squeezes that American consumers are under right now. It's just absolutely mind-boggling and deeply frustrating, Greg. We'll see how this shakes out. Maybe it won't be quite as bad as they're projecting, but at this point, I do not want to count on that.
Is heating your home a high-class problem? That's what I can't... figure out here. But hats off to Jazz Shah over at Hot Air, who has also been looking at this, because he's looking at the alternatives to fossil fuels. And he says hydroelectric power, great source of energy, pretty much maxed out on the easily dammed rivers, and new projects take a really long time. Nuclear energy is entirely carbon free, but, you know, you can't get a permit to do that anymore in this country. And there's only a handful of places in America where geothermal energy is practical. So he says, let's face it, when you eliminate all those, there's pretty much nothing left to use on an industrial scale except for fossil fuels, which we have in abundance if we're allowed to use them. And to crack down when you don't have a replacement that's, you know, viable is just the height of insanity. All right. Well, while we're waiting for the Democrats to wake up on this issue, you can wake up on the best sheets around, the Giza Dream Sheets from MyPillow. They're soft, they're comfortable. I don't know how many other adjectives I can come up with to just say these are the best sheets that we have. We love to sleep on the Giza Dream Sheets, and as soon as it's time to wash them, we wash them, put them right back on the bed. And for a limited time, you can buy one and get one free on any set of Giza Dream Sheets when you use our promo code Martini at MyPillow.com.
Haven't you been wondering, what kind of sheets does Greg sleep on? Inquiring minds want to know. Imagine sliding into the most comfortable sheets you will ever own, guaranteed. They are made from the world's best cotton, grown only in a region between the Sahara Desert, the Mediterranean Sea, and the Nile River. Its long staple cotton makes these sheets ultra soft and breathable. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, machine washable, and they come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty.
Now, for a limited time, you can buy one and get one free on all Giza Dream Sheets. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener square, and use the promo code Martini at checkout. Or call 800-874-0104 to find deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow towel sets, and so much more. Don't miss this sale of the year. That's MyPillow.com, promo code Martini, or call 800-874-0104. Sleep better with MyPillow.com. All right, Jim, our last martini is kind of bad slash crazy, but mostly bad. And that's that we're probably going to end up with an agreement on a reconciliation bill. It won't be as horrific price tag wise as the original $3.5 trillion, but somewhere around the $2 trillion mark, there seems to be excitement on the Democratic side, and that never makes me feel good. All of a sudden, Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, head of the House Progressive Caucus, is totally fine with that. And, you know, somebody got to the progressives on this. And so Joe Manchin's going to get most of what he wants. We're hearing stories that the quote-unquote free college might be cut from this bill. Joe Manchin has said that he wants some of the climate provisions taken out, which would be wonderful. But still, it's going to be a $2 trillion bill, and that's going to be very, very bad considering the trillion dollars plus in the infrastructure bill and the $2 trillion in the COVID relief bill. There's the debt's going to pile up. The cost is not zero, as Pelosi and others have said. But it's just amazing to watch everybody seemingly fall into line, or at least in terms of their sound bites here, Jim, because just a couple of days ago, Bernie Sanders was saying $3.5 trillion was a compromise, can't possibly go lower. And now somebody's gotten in the ear of the progressives, and they're seemingly getting close to a consensus around $2 trillion here.
Greg, if we're looking for a silver lining, we can observe that, yes, a $2 trillion number is significantly less than the $3.5 trillion, which is significantly less from the $6 trillion that the progressives had originally wanted during all this. But I mean, we've all seen this as a negotiating tactic. You ask for something crazy and unreasonable and way over the top, and someone says, I can't do that. But this brings their counteroffer closer to you, and you get the best deal you can from them. And you kind of wonder if that's what happened to the centrists here. Now, look, it's not done yet. There's still time. There's still hope. Things could still go wrong, and they could all end up squabbling and fighting and unable to come to a consensus. But what we've seen here is something kind of in the neighborhood of what I figured was going to happen. I wondered if at some point there would be a complete collapse, a total sense of, nope, we have no agreement. Progressives and centrists are just too far apart. Manchin and Sinema, or Cinnamon, as some people are calling them now, they're just not willing to budge on numbers that are okay for the progressives. The progressives are going to take their bat and ball and go home and, you know, accuse the other side of tanking Biden's. I thought it would get really, really bad. And then, you know, they take yet another hit in the polls, and they'd realize just how disastrous the midterms were going to be. And then everybody in the Democratic caucus would be, oh, my God, we got to pass something. And you'd throw something quickly together, and you'd end up getting something passed. It now looks like we might not go down that particular path. We're getting a softer version of that. The Democrats hit bottom. Everybody realizes they got to get something passed, and the progressives say, okay, let's get this. And I think in a way, between the two options, when you're like, okay, we have X amount to spend and we have a whole lot more than we want to do, one way to do it is to do fewer programs but fund them for the full 10 years. The other way to do it is to keep all your programs but only fund some of them for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, you know, some shorter period of time, setting up another fight to renew these programs. But as we all know, Greg, once a federal program gets created, it's very, very difficult to get rid of it. For further details, read the Weed Agency. And there's the sneaking suspicion that, you know, as much as you've seen Kyrsten Sinema get demonized and Joe Manchin is a corporatist Democrat and, you know, this fuming, that in the end, they're probably going to go along with a lot of what the progressives want. They're going to establish these programs. They're just not going to fund them for as long as the progressives would like, and setting this up for another fight a couple of years down the road, which I think if you're a fiscal conservative, you know, $2 trillion is still really bad. Alluding to something we discussed earlier in this podcast, I don't think dumping another $2 trillion on this economy is going to do anything good for inflation. I, you know, the other thing is today, Joe Biden is going to be in Scranton, Pennsylvania, a state where Bob Casey is guaranteed to vote for anything that comes across his desk. And Senator Pat Toomey, the retiring Republican of Pennsylvania and a fiscal conservative, is guaranteed to vote against anything that comes across his desk. So I don't understand why Biden's in Pennsylvania, other than just he likes to say, I'm Joe from Scranton, you know. You know, Joe Biden is going to talk about this as a jobs bill. We have 10.4 million unfilled jobs in the country right now. We have a labor shortage. We know the problem is not a lack of jobs. The problem is people don't want to do these jobs at these wages, or in a whole bunch of cases, you know, they're working parents who don't know if their kid's school is going to be open at any given time because of COVID-19. Or maybe people don't like doing those jobs anymore. Or maybe they've decided they've changed career paths during the pandemic and they don't want to go back to the old ones. You know, there's a whole bunch of contributing factors to this. But the idea that the problem with our economy is we just need to create more jobs, actually, no, that's not the problem. I mean, you know, you always like to have more jobs. When you've got 10.4 million unfilled, like, that's what's slowing down the economy. That's what's causing some of these problems. So In likelihood, we're going to get something passed. Democrats are going to celebrate. I actually don't think this is going to do them that much good in the polls, in part because I don't think this bill really addresses what is bothering the country, from the supply chains to the inflation to the border crisis to, you know, I'm going to continue beating the drum on Afghanistan. You know, there are a whole bunch of problems in this country, and I don't think the administration is really responding to it, and I don't think another giant spending bill really is the problem. But hey, they're not listening to me, Greg.
They're addressing the border, Jim. Free college for illegals.
Yeah, there you go. But not for Americans. That's what they took out of it.
So, yeah, it's not just the spending. It's what they're spending on. And you're right. If they just get the foot in the door on some of these programs that are going to be very damaging to our freedom, it's going to be very, very hard to get rid of them, even if we do very, very well in the next couple of elections. But anyway, Politico does say the odds are still stacked against the party. I'm not sure how they come to that conclusion. But anyway, we'll keep hope alive that that this will actually implode, but not looking that way right now. Jim, enjoy the rest of your day. See you on Thursday. Actually, no, you're off for the next couple of days. So enjoy that, and I'll see you again on Monday.
I am. There's a National Review Institute event in Dallas. This is actually my first really big trip since the pandemic, first time on a plane. So, you know, should be exciting. If you are listening to this and will be in Dallas, I look forward to seeing you. Otherwise, you will hear from me on Monday. Greg, keep the fort down.
I'll hold down the fort.
Hold down the fort. That's what you're supposed to do. Don't let the fort just jump up and run away. I'm not sure how often that problem happens, but nonetheless, make sure you got some paperweights and stuff.
Sounds good. Safe travels to you, Jim. John Gabriel of Ricochet will be in for Jim the next couple of days. First time we've had him as a guest host, so we'll look forward to that. And then obviously look forward to Jim being back with us on Monday. So thank you very much for listening to the Three Martini Lunch. Please subscribe if you don't already. Tell your friends about us as well. We're very grateful for your kind reviews and your 5-star ratings. Please keep those coming. Also, remember you can get us on those home devices. All you have to say is play Three Martini Lunch podcast. Finally, follow us on Twitter. He's at Jim Garrity. I'm at Dateline_DC. Have a terrific Wednesday, and please join us again on Thursday for the next Three Martini Lunch.
The Biden administration will not let the Border Patrol do its job, so the crisis is only getting worse. I'm Sarah Carter. On the latest Sarah Carter Show, Senator Marsha Blackburn joins me to discuss her frustrating trip to the border and the horrifying news that our government is giving money to human smugglers. I'll also react to stories that some Afghan people are so desperate that they are selling their own children to pay debts. Subscribe to The Sarah Carter Show at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.